wisdom from above. I don't know if you... I enjoy seeing someone do something well, whether it be folding a paper airplane or a card trick or catching a football, right? I think some folks are going to see that today. Throwing a basketball. And you can watch people throw a basketball in such a way that you're just like, that is really special. It's just something filled with air and they're trying to put it in a hoop. It's so silly. If you really think about it, it's really silly what we do to play games. But someone who gives thousands of hours to this, to practicing, to make it their life vocation, and it almost becomes artistic in how well they can do this, how well they can jump or sing or, I think, art, right? Artistic expression, paint, draw. I'm in high school, as I tried to draw, and I looked at my classmates, I remember seeing Sean, and I saw that Sean was a lot better than I was at drawing. I just looked at his skill, that he could paint, he could doodle on his paper in science class, and I would doodle too. But his were so much, there was skill there. There was innate skill that I did not have. And we look back and we appreciate that, right? Gina here, one of our own artists, right? She can take a picture, and just when she does it, she has skill that I don't have. Right? You look at my pictures, and you can tell that. Right? My mom may put my paintings on the refrigerator, but you're not going to do that. Right? Nobody else is going to put my paintings on the refrigerator because someone else has unusual skill and an unusual ability, and we enjoy that. We enjoy watching it. We enjoy seeing that life skill that that person has developed. What's interesting, though, is some people take that skill and actually use it for wrong purposes. Perhaps you saw that Dutch authorities arrested an individual for trying to sell a fake Van Gogh for $15 million and had several people interested. Fake papers made up, trying to... Right, here's artistic expression. They did a really good job at mimicking it. You couldn't tell. I couldn't tell. But it wasn't the original. And so they're actually using their skill in a very negative way, in an illegal way. And you see that as well. As someone takes a skill that God has given them, maybe that they're born with, and they develop that, and they actually use it for illegal purposes or evil purposes, evil intent, and people can even do that with speech. And so as James is talking to us about different things to overcome, and he's talking about overcoming partiality, overcoming trial, overcoming temptation, and we're going to kind of recover where we are at a different time, but I want to quickly move today into this overcoming the tongue. And he's been talking about that all through chapter 3, right? Overcoming what you say. Right, look at chapter 3, verse 1 of James. Let not many of you become teachers, because we will all, knowing that as such, we will all incur a stricter judgment. And so he says, be careful with how you talk. Verse 6, the end of verse 5 and verse 6. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. The tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body, and sets on fire the course of our life, and is set on fire by hell. And so he's talking about overcoming that tongue, and he kind of transitions a little bit into a different topic, but it is in the setting of our speech, and this is it. The different skill or wisdom that you have can be used positively or negatively. And he's going to say there's a wrong wisdom or life skill, and there's a right wisdom or life skill. There's a wisdom from above, and there's a wisdom from below. And we need to make sure that God is using through us this wisdom from above. We're developing that in our lives as gracious, compassionate, gentle people, as we'll see as the text gives us. And so he begins here with this verse 13, a challenge to the wise. There's a challenge to the wise. And then really verses 14 to 18, there's a contrast between good wisdom and bad wisdom. There's a challenge to the wise in verse 13. And in verse 14, he starts developing the wrong wisdom and describing that. And that's really verses 14 to 16. And then verse 17, look at verse 17, chapter 3. He says, but the wisdom from above, and then he describes the wisdom from above. So chapter 3, verse 13, there's this challenge, and then a contrast. 14 to 16 is the bad wisdom. And that's all we're going to have time for today, okay? So don't get nervous, right? We won't be here through the Super Bowl. We'll just look at the page 10 in your notes there. We'll just get through those verses to verse 16, and the next Sunday, Lord willing, we'll pick up at verse 17 and look at the positive wisdom, wisdom from above. But as he develops this, he's helping us, he's giving us principles for how to control our tongue, because it is a fire. And the wisdom involved in this wisdom from above is the only thing that will control our language, our speech, our temper. So a challenge to the wise, verse 13. A challenge to the wise. There's a question in verse 13, and then the actual challenge. A question. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds and the gentleness of wisdom. So you can see there's this question. Who among you is wise? That's the question. Many claim wisdom, so James is going to give them this test. Who among you? Right, we should think about that. Who is he talking to? He's not talking to politicians, secular politicians. He's not talking to businessmen and businesswomen. Right, he's not talking to educators. Though he's talking to all of them in a certain context, who's he talking to? He's saying, who among you? He's talking to fellow believers in a local church. Jewish people that had been believers in Jesus, had acknowledged him as Messiah, and he's talking to these local congregations. Okay, so as I'm reading this, as you're reading this, you're going to say, boy, I wish this politician read this. I wish my boss read this. And start, well, let's be careful to apply it first here. I wish I read this. Okay, so before you apply it to everyone else in your life, as we should, and it would be great if they did listen to it, they're not. They're not going to download this sermon. But you are here, and you are listening, so don't escape it. This message is for you. So who is the who? It's you and me in a church body. And then he asks them a question. James is good at this. Again, he keeps bringing up the questions, and you know that phrase, questions convict, accusations harden the will. He could just get up them and say, listen, you say you're wise, but you're making people angry at how you confront them, and your wisdom is not peaceable at all. It's not wisdom at all. He could do that, but instead he says, a question, who among you is wise? Who among you is wise? So that's the question. Are you wise? Are you understanding? The idea of wisdom here is a person, like we started out with, who is skilled. Skilled in an art or a trade, right? That person is a wise plumber. They know how to fix the leaky faucet. That person is wise at painting. That's the sense here. But in Scripture, there's often this broader sense of that, right? The spiritual sense of wisdom of how to live life. Life skill, not just in changing a toilet, but actually the skill of how to live, not just how to make a living. And so you read the Proverbs and you hear the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Right? The key to all of life learning is fearing God. And that's true. But there is this secular sense of wise. And so he's able to actually say there is this wisdom from above and there's this wisdom from below. Right? So it's not always positive. Solomon, the wisest person that ever lived, to that point at least, was very wise, but did he use his wisdom correctly to begin with? But then he used it very incorrectly later, improperly. And so there is this sense of wisdom, of life skill that actually can be twisted and mistreated. That is that I know how to live in such a way that benefits me and me alone. Right, so there's this wisdom and understanding, this life skill, this expertise. Like this gal really knows how to do taxes, right? That's a life skill. That's wisdom and understanding in that aspect. And it would be very prized in that culture. Everyone would want that type of wisdom and understanding. And so James asks them, do you have wisdom? And I ask you today, do you have wisdom? Well, he's going to challenge them then. Look at the challenge, verse 13. You have wisdom and understanding. Any of you wise and understanding? Well, here's your challenge. Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. An opening question. You say you're wise. Well, I'm going to give you a challenge. Show it. It's like if I had a Rubik's Cube or some puzzle up here. I said, any of you think you're good at puzzles? All right, come up here, take this, and fix the puzzle in 5 minutes or less, blindfolded. All right, I give you a challenge to demonstrate that you can do puzzles. James says, you say you're wise? Well, let me give you this challenge. And look at the challenge. Let him show his good behavior, his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. What is the action of the challenge here? Let him do what? Show. Demonstrate. You think you have wisdom? Well, show it. You have a skill or ability? Show it. Right? You can knit. You can paint. You can translate. You can live well. Well, show it. Demonstrate it. How can you demonstrate it? Let him show it by what? By his good behavior in good deeds. All right. Demonstrate your wisdom through actually doing something. Your good behavior, talking about your character, often translated your manner of life, the way you live as others see it. A New Yorker-ism would be good people's. I know my night watchman coworker would always say that. Joe, he's good people's. What does he mean by that? He means he is good character, right? Like he's well spoken of. People like him. He wouldn't say that about everybody, but Joe's good people's. Well, James says, you say you're wise, you say you know how to live, demonstrate it through good behavior. And how is your good behavior demonstrated? In your deeds, in your actions. Not just words, I'm a good person, but your actions. Your character is demonstrated through your actions. That you're working for others, that you're helping others. You're ready today to show your skill, your wisdom. Well, what are you doing? What are you doing? What is your behavior telling? A good illustration of this is Tabitha. Anybody know who Tabitha is? Tabitha is from Acts chapter 9, where Luke talks about a lady. He says, this woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. It happened that she fell sick and died. The disciples, having heard that Peter was there, sent two of them, begging him, do not delay in coming to us. Peter came, right? And there all the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing all the tunics and garments that Tabitha had made for them while she was with them. And Peter prayed and she rose from the dead, right? But here is a lady known for her good deeds. She didn't just say she was a good person, right? She knitted and made clothing for poor widows that had no other means of clothing themselves in that culture. She took care of them. What is your Tabitha? Right? What is your good deeds that is demonstrating a changed character? That you're good people's because God has changed you on the inside and it's overflowing through what you do. Again, everything we do should be for the Lord, whether we eat or drink or whatever we do. But are there specific deeds that you're demonstrating that your character has changed? Right? Shoveling someone's walkway, taking a meal to someone, taking time to help someone with the life problem, listening to someone, praying with someone, feeding the poor, right? Checking in on an elderly person, helping a beggar on the street, asking if they need a meal, demonstrating good deeds. The church needs so many Tabithas. We all need to be Tabithas in the church. A family needs Tabithas. A community needs Tabithas. People who are genuinely expressing a changed heart by the way they work for others. And so he's going to give them this question, this challenge: who among you is wise and understanding? Well, let me see those skills, those life skills demonstrated by deeds to others, but there's a manner in which you need to carry out these deeds, right? It's not just doing good deeds. You do good deeds in what? The gentleness of wisdom. You're doing good behavior with this attitude of gentleness and meekness. I'm not doing these good deeds so everyone will look at me. Look what I did. Right? Did you guys see how good that was? Right? Or making a whole list of all the good stuff I do. No, this is just a natural expression of my actions because I have a gentle humility that doesn't think of self but thinks of others and naturally tries to serve others. It's a servant's heart that desires to live for God and others. Right, so Tabitha's deeds were to serve others. And they recognized that this was from a genuine heart of love and not a heart of selfishness. The spirit of Tabitha's working needs to be in all of us. Not thinking of what can I get out of this if I do it for my own benefit, but how can I serve others for their benefit? So let's move on from the question here, and he's going to dwell on this a little bit more as we continue. Look at verse 14 as we move from the question to the contrast of wisdom. He's going to give a picture of this bad wisdom, this life skill used in such a way that's for my self-aggrandizement. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. So we look first at this bad wisdom in the contrast. And again, we're not going to have time today to look at the positive one, but it is beautiful. Just memorize this passage. It's a beautiful passage. Look at the wisdom from below, first of all. The wisdom from below, verses 14 to 16. Look at the test. There's a litmus test for bad wisdom. Right, he gives them a challenge to see, do you have wisdom from above or wisdom from below? Now he's going to give us all a test to see whether our life skills are being used in one way or the other. Here's the test, verse 14. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. Right, there's three factors about this test. Right, these kind of like a self-administered blood test. Right, he does say it's in your heart, and so there's certain things that should not be in your blood. Identifying a child's blood level, right, the lead in their blood can be difficult or dangerous. The CDC says blood lead equal to or above 5 micrograms per deciliter. So remember that, for all of you with children, right? That's a bad level of blood, lead in their blood. And so we check our blood and we make sure that this is not too high and that's not too high. Well, James is giving us a test we can self-administer, okay? So I don't know you. I don't know your life in and out. I know you somewhat, but I don't know everything about you, but you do. And so I want you to take this test. Test your wisdom today. Is your life skill that you're demonstrating from above or from below? Is it right wisdom or wrong wisdom? Well, here's your tests. There are two elements that can be found inside your life skill or your activities that demonstrate a clear sign. If you're holding on to these, if you're grasping these in your life, then you do not have the right wisdom. Look at the two elements. The first one is what? Is bitter jealousy. But if you have bitter jealousy in your heart, is this in your life, in the actions, the good deeds that you do for others? It's one test. Do I have bitter jealousy? The term refers to being zealous, and actually can be used in a positive way. Jesus was zealous for his Father's house, the temple, as he drove out the money changers and said, "You all have the wrong motive. You're actually extortioning the people. This should be a house of prayer." They were taking advantage of others. And so Jesus' zeal was used in a positive way, but it also can be used in an extremely negative way. Right? This was the religious leaders in Acts as they saw Peter preaching, and he had great boldness preaching the gospel of Jesus. And what was the response from the people? The response was that they believed in Jesus and they started following Peter and these apostles. And Luke says that those religious leaders were filled with jealousy and took them and threw them into prison. Right, that's our word here. The idea of seeing something and you're jealous of it. You have a zealous envy. This coveting spirit that really is a heart problem. It gets deep into why you do what you do. And that's why I can't test this. I can't judge you. No one else can judge you. You can judge you, and only you can judge you. Judge your heart. Why are you doing what you're doing? Is there a jealousness for God or a jealousness for self? Is there a zeal for self-notoriety, self-glory, self-promotion? Coveting is such a sneaky thing. It's one of the Ten Commandments, but it's so sneaky. You can be doing all the right things, but have all the wrong motives. This type of jealousy leaves a bitter taste in your mouth, right? It's bitter jealousy. This type of zeal for self actually leaves a bitter taste when others don't see your work, when others don't notice. You work, you expend, you serve, you use your skill, your wisdom with words or with art or with cleaning or whatever your skill is, and nothing else comes back to you. No one else noticed. And they didn't notice that I took care of that person, or they didn't notice that I spent that time with that person. Well, I'm bitter. That's a test. If you're bitter, if you're souring because of it, then it was not the wisdom from above. It's the wrong wisdom. If your wisdom is from above, then this service is a bubbling spring coming out of a heart that's changed, and you're ready to wash people's feet. It's the wisdom of a servant, the gentleness. I remember serving a man. This was in a different neighborhood that I don't normally get to, but I bought him a good meal because he was begging for money, and so I got him a good meal. He was a hefty individual. But I bought him a meal, and he didn't say thank you at all. He was very rude. I was trying to talk to him to learn, you know, the struggles he was going through. Just completely ignored me and just ate in a rather rude way right in front of me. Well, you know, I'm not doing this for me. Years later, at the same neighborhood, the same individual, the same meal, the same response. And I was like, oh. I was hoping for something different. A thank you. A change. But it really showed my motives. Right? In one sense, right? Okay, we want to see people change. But I should be willing to serve, to wash the person's feet no matter what their response. I'm not doing it for a thank you. I'm not doing it to be noticed or be on the news. I'm doing it to help. Because this is a changed heart that helps this person. So actually, our actions can be such that we are doing it for ourselves. This is so dangerous for church workers, for pastors, for ministers. And this is why many burn out, because there's a continual serving. But if the service isn't for Christ, then it's an empty service, and it's one that you will wear out on. But Christians are servants. Teachers are servants. Parents are servants. Disciple makers are servants. We cannot be narcissists. We must be servants. We must be motivated by God and others. A self-motivation will end up leaving you this bitter feeling. You'll have this bitter feeling, and you'll know that it was wisdom not from above. The second one, jealousy and selfish ambition. Right? This is the other test that you find it in your blood. If you realize it's there, then it's just a clear indication that I'm doing this for the wrong reasons. There's this zeal for self, this coveting, and we'll see that in chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. He gets into that a little more carefully. But the second part of the test is that it's this selfish ambition. This word only occurs this place in the New Testament, as referring to a self-seeking politicking, I guess, if that's a word. It actually is a political word. Someone doing what they need, not for principle, but pandering for the next position by being factional, by causing strife. Right? The political pressing of every tiny thing and not willing to budge a bit in order to please this small group that's padding my pocket. And that happens. Happens all the time. I'm reading this in politics, right? I enjoy reading history. It's not just now. It's been ever since there was any type of politics. And it's in your office. It's an office politics. It's everywhere. This happens. Every time there's an organized system, there's this pushing back and forth. Because actually this word was used in this sense by Aristotle hundreds of years before James wrote this. One commentator states, as Aristotle's using it, the narrow partisan zeal of factional greedy politicians. But that spirit can drive you too. Right, it's just focusing on that one aspect instead of all the notes on the piano, that one note that you like in the Bible, and you're going to nail that one, bam, 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 till everybody's like, I got to get out of here. That's the only thing they're talking about. And it's a minor thing, but you're driving it so much that it's all you talk about. Right, that is what it's talking about. That's not the wisdom from above. Right, there are major issues and there are minor issues in the house. And if you only focus on all the tiny minor issues and make those the major issues, the house will suffer. There are certain things we should not, right, we should agree to disagree on. Let that be in your blood. I'm not talking about the major aspects of clear teaching in the Bible. Right? We're told we contend for the faith, right? Wrestle, agonize for it. When these minor points, we cannot make them major points. I like this joke. It's used often, but I think it well illustrates this. This guy says, once I saw a guy on a bridge about to jump, and I said, don't do it. He said, nobody loves me. I said, God loves you. Do you believe in God? He said, yes. I said, are you Jewish or Christian? He said, I'm a Christian. I said, me too. Are you Protestant or Catholic? He said, Protestant. I said, me too. What denomination? He said, Baptist. I said, me too. Are you Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist? And he said, Northern Baptist. And I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist? And he said, Northern Conservative Baptist. I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region or Northern Conservative Baptist Eastern region? He said, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region. I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region Council of 1879 or Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region Council of 1912. And he said, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region Council of 1912. I said, die, heretic, and I pushed him over. Right, we can get that spirit of factiousness about minor things. And it's disease in a church, right? We agree to disagree on many things. On many things. Now, you can hold your positions even on these minor issues, but be careful how you place them on others, not domineering or being, again, the only note on the piano that you hammer home. And be teachable, ready to listen to the other person's viewpoint. I'm going to skip over this. Dr. Seuss has a great poem on this. The north-going Zacks and the south-going Zacks that kind of stand together for 59 years. But anyway, we get the point. If you will not budge on anything, then that may be demonstrating this spirit on these minor issues. I'm not talking the clear teaching of Scripture, but these minor issues. We even say even some denominational issues that we could just say, you know what, let's agree to disagree. You're not going to convince me, I'm not going to convince you. We're going to love each other in heaven forever. So let's get over it in our family. Have you ever agreed to disagree on something that was a minor issue? Have you ever backed down on anything? Are you able to listen to someone else's view before blasting them with the only view that you know makes sense? Well, then maybe this is you. Maybe this test is something you need to take. Right? This, am I this schismatic person? But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. Right? The test is twofold. The test is internal and the test is conclusive. This internal test is something that you cannot lie against. Do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. In your arrogance, don't say, well, that's not me, that's not me. No, listen, be true to reason and understand that you do not have the wisdom from above. You're failing the test. If you take the test and you come up short, realize that this needs to be changed. Because wisdom has humility, verse 13, right? Let him show his good behavior, his deeds, and the gentleness of wisdom. Gentleness, approachableness, humility. And that is the test for wisdom. And this is the scary part. Look at verse 15. The scary part is the source of this wrong wisdom. The source of this wrong wisdom is that it comes from below. This is something we have to understand. We have to pay attention to this. The wisdom that is that way is not from above, right? It doesn't come from heaven. You can say it is all you want, but it doesn't come from heaven. It comes from, and then he talks about these three ways, these three sources, and they're kind of climactic. They go from bad to worse. This wisdom from below is earthly, natural, demonic. It's earthly, meaning secular. It's of the earth, and this is what society wants us to do with anything religious. Well, you can have your belief in God just on Sunday for 3 hours. Right? Just don't bring it into science. Right? Don't bring it into morality in society. Right? Don't bring it into anything else. Right? The schoolroom. You can have it, just make sure it's quiet on Sundays. And that's what the world wants us to do. That is earthly thinking. That is secular thinking. Not necessarily thinking bad about God, just not thinking about God. That leads into this type of thinking, this worldly thinking, this earthly wisdom. It goes from earthly to natural. This word is often used to contrast those things that are spiritual, those things that are from above, from God, the Holy Spirit. In contrast to that, there's this natural, this, we would say, carnal, this fleshly ideology. It's the opposite of what is spiritual. And then we realize that ultimately goes not just earthly, natural, but demonic. The progression from bad to worse, realizing that the ultimate source of these types of things are Satan. The Bible says that there are doctrines of demons. And often it's not, you know, this brazen in your face, it's just a little lie. It's what Satan whispered to Eve in the garden. The serpent was crafty, and he said to the woman, "Indeed, has God said you shall not eat from the tree of the..." He's asking questions too. Right? Has God really said, Tim, did God really say it just like that? And he just plants that little deceptive thought in your mind. It changes the way you start living. That's what Satan wants to do with his worldly wisdom. Secular, then unspiritual, and then eventually, actually, you're listening to Satan's lies. C.S. Lewis illustrates this temptation as he tells the story of two demons riding back and forth together, one a mentor to the other, Screwtape. And he's talking about a man who's sitting in the British Museum. He said, I once had a patient, a sound atheist, who used to read in the British Museum. One day as he sat reading, I saw a train of thought in his mind beginning to go the wrong way. The enemy, of course, was at his elbow in a moment. Before I knew where I was, my 20 years' work beginning to totter. If I had lost my head and begun to attempt a defense by argument, I should have been undone. But I was not such a fool. I struck instantly at the part of the man which I had best under my control and suggested that it is just about time he had some lunch. The enemy presumably made the counter-suggestion that this was more important than lunch. At least I think I must have been his line, for he said, quite, in fact, much too important to tackle at the end of a morning. The patient brightened up considerably, and by the time I had added, much better come back after lunch and go in with a fresh mind, he was already halfway to the door. Once he was in the street, the battle was won. I showed him a newsboy shouting the midday paper, number 73 bus going past, and before he reached the bottom of the steps, I got him into an unalterable conviction that whatever odd ideas might come into man's head when he shut up alone with his books, a healthy dose of real life was enough to show him all that sort of thing just couldn't be true. It's a narrow escape. Well, these are the things that Satan puts into the mind, suggestions, lies, outright lies about God and reality. We need to be filling our minds with wisdom from above, as we'll see next week. Look at the outcome, verse 16, the outcome of this bad wisdom. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. Right? As you give yourself to this wisdom, this speech that is earthly, natural, demonic, it manifests itself not in peaceable gentleness as comes from Christ, but it exhibits itself in this outcome, disorder and every evil thing. Disorder and every evil thing. And God wants everything in the church to be done decently and in order. But when this type of attitude is common in those in church or in different areas of society, we see an unusual disunity that actually does boil over into all kinds of disorder. And then it says every evil thing springs out of this. You open it up this much, and then it's like all types of evil will come out of this. Let us be those who are filled with wisdom from above, changing us to be gently using our good gifts for God's glory. And then these other minor things, as Augustine said, in essentials unity, in doubtful matters liberty, in all things charity. And these minor things, let them lie where they lay in minor areas. By God's grace, using my own skill, not for my glory, but for God's glory. Heads bowed and eyes closed. Let me just ask you the searching question to take the test. I think the first test for us all would be, am I working for others? Am I doing any type of activity for God and others? God has given you a special skill set that no one else has. Sometimes it's not even your vocation, but He wants us to find that and serve Him and His church through it. Let me encourage you to pray, Lord, where is my Tabitha? I'm not looking for a spouse, but Lord, what type of Tabitha activity do you want me to extend? What is it in my hand that I can use for God's glory? If you'd like some practical suggestions, talk to Pastor Andrew. We have 12 ministry teams that we'd love to plug you into. But think, right, church-wise, but community-wise even, right? Where can I use my gifts for God's glory? And then if you are serving and you find yourself embittered, is it because you're serving with a skill from below and it's just self-motivated? Or is it wisdom from above? Heads bowed and eyes closed. Let's all do business with the Lord. I'll be standing at the back before we close in prayer. If you would like counsel, please slip out to the back. And let's all, though, respond to God's message before we lead in a closing prayer.